Jane Goodall once said, "The least I can do is speak out for those who cannot speak for themselves." She's applied that motto to every single thing she does, whether it's promoting conservation projects in developing countries or protecting the chimpanzees of Tanzania. And in her new book, she writes,
"It's true that we're experiencing the sixth great extinction on Earth, with thousands of species disappearing forever every year. And while we sink into despair or anger, there is yet this feeling of hope. Reports of fascinating new species discovered or rediscovered give me new strength to face and fight the challenges that threaten our still mysterious, still magical planet."
That is Jane Goodall reading from her new book, Hope for Animals and Their World. And Jane Goodall is here in the studio with me. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
This book is a series of stories about different animal species that were rescued from the brink of extinction. You describe the plight of the American whooping crane. In the middle of the last century, there were fewer than a few dozen left in the United States. Today, there are hundreds. How were they rescued?
It's a wonderful story. The one flock that was known was flying from Texas to somewhere unknown in Canada. And each year when they came back, there were fewer, until they were reduced to no more than 27 individuals. And then finally, luckily, their breeding place was discovered, and it was decided to do a captive breeding program. But the problem was, if something like bird flu hit that flock, that would be finished. So it was very important to start another flock in another place. But that meant teaching the young birds to follow on the route, because they learn from their parents. So what they used was an ultralight, and I went to visit this project, and I got to go up in an ultralight.
You got to fly.
It was one of the most amazing experiences. It's like being a bird, because you're out there in the air and looking down at these beautiful birds. These are the adolescents, still with some golden cinnamon feathers. And it's been very successful.
I was struck by another example you write about in the book, the American burying beetle. And you write that it's easy for most people to sort of want to save cute and cuddly animals like pandas or snow leopards. But this beetle is also vital.
The beetle is really important because it buries carrion. So if a small bird dies, the beetle will bury it. And the beetles smell the rotting carrion from about 2 miles away. They arrive, a male will bond with a female. They work together to bury the carcass. They then mate. The female lays her eggs on the carcass, but they don't leave. They make a little chamber. Mum and dad stay in the chamber until the babies hatch. They then go to the carcass and chew it up. They feed the babies, and then when that's done, they leave. The man who's working on the burying beetle, Lou Perotti, he said a lady came along and she said, "Your beetles look after their young much better than my children looked after my grandchildren." And she gave him $75,000.
Wow.
I mean, isn't this a lovely story? Beetles.
How do you make the case for insects, for beetles, when, in a sense, you're competing in this marketplace for donations and for support from benefactors for, as you write, animals that are, cute.
Charismatic.
Yeah.
What's so fascinating is the more I've lived and traveled and talked with people and seen with my own eyes, the more I realize how interrelated everything is. And there are stories where, one little insect or plant or something becomes extinct. And it doesn't seem to matter, but it turns out that that was a major food source for another creature. And so gradually there's a chain reaction, and you can have an entire ecosystem collapse just because one piece was taken out and we didn't realize what that would do.
Jane Goodall, next year marks 50 years since you first went to live with the chimpanzees at Gombe National Park in Tanzania. Is that right?
Correct.
You developed an emotional connection to the chimpanzees you studied. And in this book, you point out how those kinds of relationships between researcher and animal have been crucial to saving many of these species.
I believe that that's absolutely true. All the people that I've talked with perhaps come from a discipline where it's not considered scientific to have any kind of empathy with the animal you study. You're supposed to be cold and scientific. But they've just about all of them. Sometimes it was almost like a confession. yes, we do have a personal connection with these creatures. And we do this work because we love it and because we just couldn't bear to let them vanish.
You are on the road now for some 300 days a year. When will you take a rest?
What is that word? I don't know. I mean, it'll obviously depend on my health and how long I can keep up this absurd pace. I worry about my carbon footprint with flying everywhere, but I don't have a magic carpet. What I've learned during the rather magical adventure of writing this book is that even when we believe everything is finished, there still is hope. People have this indomitable spirit that won't give up.
Jane Goodall's new book is called Hope for Animals and Their World. She joined us here in the studio. Jane Goodall, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Billions of dollars of economic stimulus money is going to build bridges, improve infrastructure, and help people avoid housing foreclosures. But there's also a tiny bit of that money, $167 million, to restore 50 coastal habitats in the country. William Wilma Consul visited two of those sites in Hawaii.
On this windy morning on the shores of Mauna Loa Bay, a group of about 20 people hold hands in a circle to pray in Hawaiian before the day's task. These folks are volunteers and staff from Malama Mauna Loa, a grassroots effort of various community groups to malama, or care for, the bay. Alyssa Miller coordinates.
Be sure you wear safety equipment, booties, gloves. Know where the first aid kit is. It's right over here. Drink plenty of water and go out there, have fun, and be safe.
In the days of Hawaii's monarchy and before the islands became a state, Mauna Loa Bay fed nearby villages with its bounty of fishes. Now, this body of water east of Honolulu has deteriorated. Pollution and overdevelopment have played a role, but it's the invasive algae known as leather mudweed that has caused extensive damage to the bay. Alyssa Miller and I wade the waist-deep water. She familiarizes me with the species.
So you feel that squishy stuff under your feet?
Yes.
That's our target. It's that green invasive marine algae with a black, smelly mud under it.
It feels like quicksand.
The mudweed traps sediment in about 54 acres of the bay and smothers coral. Clearing the bay will allow for new growth of native and non-invasive weeds.
Russellaria, gorilla, ogo, leather mud.
The Nature Conservancy of Hawaii is a partner in this $3.4 million project. Executive Director Suzanne Case says the federal stimulus funding will boost what has been small-scale community work.
And so you can just imagine if we're able to get 60 people out here, you know, every day pulling algae, and, you know, we'll be able to get, hopefully, we think about 22 acres over a year and a half.
In total, Hawaii received a little more than $6 million for coastal restoration, creating about 88 jobs for both the Oahu and the Big Island projects. The numbers may seem small, but in Hawaii, this is a big help. The unemployment rate is 7%, and more than 45,000 people are out of work. Tourism is down, Aloha Airlines shut down, and many businesses have closed. 31-year-old Andy Agustin is one of the new hires of the Kohala Watershed Restoration Project on the Big Island.
You know, this hard time to make it right now because the economy is so low. It's super low. It's the lowest I've ever seen it since I could remember. Rice is almost $15. How's that, you know? That's bad.
Agustin is in charge of building a 20-mile fence to keep away the feral goats that eat up vegetation and leave the land bare. These animals, introduced by Western settlers to the islands over 200 years ago, are a big threat to Pelikane Bay near the Kohala coast. The bay is now covered in 6 to 10 feet of mud, but it should be pristine and clear. Agustin drove down this rocky mountain road with the project's 14 new hires.
Akia, a.k.a. Akia, incredibly wind-tolerant.
This crew's job is to replant native seeds on 400 acres of soil on this watershed. Toby Kailimai is 18 and quite psyched about this job.
I'm just pumped, stoked every day, more and more pumped. My friends, my family members wish they had this job, and it's a good opportunity for me.
At Pelikane Bay is the sacred ground of Pu'u Kohola, the temple or heiau built by Hawaii's first king, Kamehameha, for uniting all the islands.
To be a part of restoring the native plants, putting back the rocks into the heiaus is something nobody else does on this island, really.
Why is it that important for you?
I'm Hawaiian. It's my culture. My family's deep into the culture. And it's a fading culture, as you can tell, in these islands. And I want to keep it strong, at least in my family and my blood.
The massive task of working the land of his paradise home can rightfully be a local boy's dream. It's a good thing for now. Hawaii's economy, like the rest of the country, will take time to recover. For NPR News, I'm Wilma Consul.
A year ago this weekend, U.S. Treasury officials came to a fateful decision that exposed the fragility of the financial markets. Lehman Brothers was allowed to go bankrupt, and the Dow dropped more than 500 points in a single day. Then the insurance giant AIG nearly collapsed, and some of the biggest names in banking came to the government looking for help. Many of the names in the news at the time, Richard Fuld from Lehman, John Thain from Merrill Lynch, Kenneth Lewis from Bank of America, all share one major thing in common. They are, of course, men. And according to Deborah Spar, this helps to explain a lot about what happened in the run-up to the financial meltdown. Deborah Spar is a former professor at Harvard Business School and now the president of Barnard College in New York. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Deborah Spar, you argue that the meltdown might not have happened if women headed these financial institutions. What do you mean?
One of the ideas that's been floating around since the meltdown is that women in particular may approach risk differently than men. They may, in the aggregate, because obviously individuals are all different, but in the aggregate, women tend to be more averse to risk than men. And insofar as a great chunk of this meltdown was the result of people, men, having taken on way too much risk, we could very well have gotten a different outcome had there been more women's voices in these rooms at critical points in time.
You wrote an article back in January in the Washington Post, and you cited a study done by Cambridge University professors that ties high testosterone levels to high profits on the financial trading floor.
What these two scientists did was they measured men's testosterone levels in the morning and then looked at their behavior on the trading floors during the day. And it turns out that when these men had higher levels of testosterone, they made riskier and oftentimes more profitable trades.
And so obviously the conclusion one would reach is that women wouldn't make those kinds of decisions.
Well, you know, I think we have to be careful here because we need a lot more studies. But I do think we can at least start playing with the idea that if women do approach risk differently, then they might make less risky decisions and take less risky positions than men would.
Mm. Deborah Spar, next month, and this is according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, women are set to outnumber men in the workforce for the first time in U.S. history. It may already have happened. Isn't that encouraging?
The short answer is yes, it's encouraging. I think the long answer is that one wants to look much more closely at this data. And what I imagine you'll find is that while the total number of women may be greater than men, the higher and higher you go, particularly in the high-paid professions, the fewer women you see in those roles.
Why do you think that is?
I don't think we know. I don't think it's because the men are kicking them out, but women are choosing to step out of these roles before they reach the highest levels. In many cases, they are finding it harder than men are to juggle professional lives with personal lives, particularly once those lives include children. And I think we are seeing evidence that insofar as any given group remains predominantly male, it's harder for women to become part of that. By the same token, there have been a number of professions, veterinary medicine for one, that have in fact become dominated by women.
Do you think that if women were the majority of the traders at the New York Stock Exchange on the floor there, on the financial floor there, we would have seen the Dow rise to over 14,000?
My guess would be you would not have seen the heights on the Dow and you wouldn't have seen the lows. You would have seen a more middle-of-the-road, more conservative development.
Deborah Spar is the president of Barnard College in New York and a former professor at Harvard Business School. Deborah Spar, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Paul Rudnick is a screenwriter, playwright, and humorist whose work appears frequently in The New Yorker. He doesn't seem like the kind of guy who would shy away from fame, but Rudnick ended his first foray into making a major Hollywood movie by politely asking that his name be removed from the credits. The movie, Sister Act, starring Whoopi Goldberg, went on to become a big success. Rudnick's take on the behind-the-scenes machinations that went into the making of it is just one of many funny stories included in his latest book, I Shudder. Paul Rudnick joins us now from our New York studio. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So let's begin with Sister Act. Why exactly did you try to disown this film?
Well, here's the short version. What was intended as a satire of movies like The Singing Nun and TV shows like The Flying Nun and all of those hug-happy, sugary nun flicks turned into one of those. So by the time the Disney people got through with my original script, it bore very little resemblance to what I intended. So I thought it was best to bow out as gracefully as possible. And Disney didn't quite see it that way. And they wanted me to keep my name on the film. So what we finally settled on was the choice of a pseudonym. But Disney had full approval of whatever name was selected, and because first I wanted to say screenplay by Goofy, and they didn't go for that. Then finally, I picked kind of out of thin air the name Joseph Howard. Joseph actually was the name of a character in a story I'd written, and Howard is my brother's middle name. So it now says on the screen of In Sister Act, written by Joseph Howard, which still sounds to me like someone who helped found the Mormon Church.
Now, you actually spent time at a convent doing research for that movie, which I was very surprised to learn.
Well, what it was a several-year process as I went through many drafts of the script, and I'd find myself out in Los Angeles on the Disney lot discussing the difference between a Benedictine and a Franciscan order and all sorts of papal dogma in rooms filled with Jews, myself included. So finally, Bette Midler, who at that point was going to star in the film, said, you know, I think Paul should go to a convent for some hands-on research. So I was shipped by bus to the Regina Laudes Convent in Bethlehem, Connecticut, which was a revelation to me. It was fascinating. It ended up not fueling the film almost at all because real convents are very different from those in Disney romps.
Now, being gay is very much a part of who you are. It's a part of the way you write, what you write about. And you've written that when you were growing up, you thought everybody was gay.
I did. I think I was enormously and appallingly egocentric. I was very sort of pleased with my life in a suburb of Jersey. So it didn't occur to me that anyone was different from me. But basically, I just didn't divide the world into gay and straight. If I had to make any kind of differentiations, I would put people into folks from New Jersey and folks from New York. And that seemed like more than enough judgment.
That suburb of New Jersey was Piscataway, New Jersey.
You
write about that in this book. And I'm not sure you're going to win any friends there with your description of the town. But I would like you to read at least a little portion of that description, and it's on page 212, starting I Was Raised.
Yes. I was raised in the suburb of Piscataway, where the Chamber of Commerce sponsored a promotional billboard picturing two cartoon Native Americans in feathers and striped war paint. One of these braves was shading his eyes with his hand and scanning the horizon above the caption, "They went Piscataway." Piscataway is also the home to many industrial parks, where gracefully landscaped acreage surrounds the buildings that market bath towels, silicone breast implants, and napalm.
Not really. Was there such a billboard as that? They went Piscataway?
Absolutely. No, and I must say, I loved Piscataway. It was a great place to grow up because it was a suburb, and suburbs are pretty much designed for the worship of small children, which is what I was at the time.
You know, you have written in so many different media. You've written novels, essays, films, plays. And I wondered if there was one that you like more than the other, or if there's one where you're able to express yourself more that really sort of reflects who you are, which one do you like best?
It's funny. Well, it's a hard question to answer because I've been continually surprised. I never expected to become a screenwriter or a novelist for that matter, or to write a book of essays. But what I've learned is to let the content absolutely dictate the form. The essays in I Shudder were about subjects and people that I tried to fictionalize at various points, and I felt I wasn't doing them justice. I really wanted to celebrate some very special men and women. And suddenly, when I tried the essay form and tried nonfiction, that felt right. So I've learned not to pick favorites, although I must confess, there is something about theater where there's the live response, there's working with the actors, there's a family feeling there, and a certain high that you get, especially when you work on stage comedies, when the audience is with you, when they're shooting the whole experience that much higher, that really can't be duplicated anywhere else. But it's on the other hand, when you write books, you have this ultimate godlike control, and that is extremely tempting. So, and when you write movies, it's kind of wonderful and a little scary, because when I worked on the Addams Family films, I remember sitting in my little New York apartment and typing out, Gomez and Morticia enter a decaying French bistro. And then a few months later, I walked onto a soundstage in Hollywood where hundreds of thousands of dollars had been spent to build this decaying French bistro. And I suffered an immediate panic attack where I thought, oh, my God, couldn't we have used this money to send some kids to college or build some huts, you know, so that the budgets in Hollywood can be both exhilarating and daunting. So, yeah, no, they're all my children.
Paul Brudnick, his new book is I Shudder. Thanks so much for being with us, Paul.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary. Norman Borlaug, known as the father of the Green Revolution, died last night at his home in Dallas. He was 95 years old. Borlaug was an agricultural scientist who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970 for his work fighting famine in third world nations. NPR's Dan Charles has this remembrance.
When Norman Borlaug was a teenager in Cresco, Iowa, he was a star wrestler. He kept that same tenacity and combativeness throughout his life. He studied agricultural science, and when he was 30, he accepted an offer from the Rockefeller Foundation and moved to a small research station in Mexico. He was assigned to breed better varieties of wheat. Clarence Peterson, a fellow wheat breeder from Washington State University, occasionally visited him there.
He always went out to the farm to start working at about 4:30 in the morning. And if you wanted to talk to Dr. Borlaug, that's when you went with him. That was it. Boy, he worked probably 10, 12 hours a day, every day, while he was in Mexico.
The key to his biggest breakthrough came from Japan, a kind of wheat with a very short stalk. Other wheat breeders were experimenting with offspring from this dwarf wheat and getting encouraging results.
It turned out that the wheat that they brought in from Japan not only shortened the stature of the wheats, but greatly increased production.
Borlaug used that line of wheat and many others. He worked on a large scale and he worked fast, doubling the pace of his breeding program by continuing work through the winter in a separate warm weather location. Borlaug then took his new varieties out to villages across Mexico. In a 1974 interview with the public radio show Options, Borlaug explained that it was the only way to persuade a farmer to plant the new seed.
He won't do this if it's done on an experiment station, a government experiment station, because he can't tell how much science and technology went into that and how much witchcraft. But if it's done on his own land, if he participates in putting in this demonstration, if you provoke this big increase in yield, he's very receptive.
The Borlaug method succeeded in Mexico, and in the 1960s, with the support of the Rockefeller and the Ford Foundations, he took his campaign to India and other parts of Asia. Again, wheat breeder Clarence Peterson.
He was very persuasive. He was more involved in politics almost than he was in agriculture when he went to these countries. What he did is he went to the people who were in charge of agriculture in India and convince them to take a complete package, not only the wheat, but fertilizer and improve their everything in their production.
That combination, high-yielding seeds, fertilizer, expanded irrigation, and government subsidies, produced the Green Revolution. Production boomed. Similar advances happened with rice farming. And instead of mass famines in South Asia, as many had predicted, the region became self-sufficient in wheat and rice. In 1970, Borlaug was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. In the decades since, his work has come in for criticism. Some say the Green Revolution made rich farmers richer and left poorer farmers behind. In some areas, heavy use of agricultural chemicals has harmed the environment. Borlaug, meanwhile, turned his attention to Africa and found it difficult to achieve success there. In a 1997 interview at member station WAMU, Borlaug said thousands of trials in farmers' fields all across the continent had shown how to double, even triple, farmers' production.
So the potential's there, but you can't eat potential. The transport system is miserable. We have to bring in fertilizer. And as soon as you get these little farms producing, there has to be better transport to move the excess grain to the cities of those countries where there's food shortages.
Even as he got older, Borlaug never ended his campaign for expanded agriculture in the poorest parts of the world.
I'm hopeful that I will live to see, and it's got to happen fairly soon because I'm 83. I want to see this happen in Africa, like I saw it happen in India, Pakistan, Turkey.
Borlaug never saw that happen, but he did live to see a fresh wave of interest in African agriculture. Dan Charles, NPR News, Washington.
If Evan Ratliff has a weakness for gluten-free pizza, he might want to try
the vegan, a gluten-free cupcake, and it has crystallized violets on top. So everything's completely natural. We use organic sugar. It's really delicious. I'm a huge fan of the frosting.
That's Brittany Frick. She's one of the pastry chefs at the Red Velvet Cupcakery. It opened a few months ago, about three blocks away from NPR headquarters here in Washington. Now, Red Velvet is one of six cupcake bakeries that have opened up in the city over the past 18 months alone, and there are more to come. And Washington is pretty late to the game. New York and L.A. have had them for years. But it turns out there's a nationwide cupcake boom underway with new bakeries opening up from Arizona to Connecticut. Anyway, we were wondering what was causing the cupcake proliferation, so we sent out our producer, Selena Simmons-Duffin, to investigate. And Selena has brought back her scientific empirical findings and is with me in the studio. Selena, you seem a little jumpy there.
Yeah, I've consumed so much sugar in the past few days. I think I've eaten about a dozen cupcakes.
That's pretty disgusting. what is going on with all of these cupcake shops?
Well, it turns out there's an economic theory behind the cupcake boom. I called up Daniel Gross. He wrote about it in Slate, and he called it a classic economic bubble. So here's what he said.
Like most trends, it started almost simultaneously in Los Angeles and New York. So this is what typically happens. A chain gets started one place. It proliferates the local area, and then it quickly tries to go national.
So the start of the bubble was in the big cities. Like, you might remember a couple years ago when Sarah Jessica Parker's character in Sex and the City got a cupcake at Magnolia Bakery, and then that same shop showed up in a digital short from Saturday Night Live with Andy Samberg.
Two, no, six, no, 12, make a dozen. I told you that I'm crazy for these cupcakes, cousin.
So Dan Gross says the popularity of shops like Magnolia inspired a bunch of other stores, and that's what started the cupcake bubble.
Okay, so where in this bubble cycle are we now?
Well, Warren Buffett has a great way of breaking down the cycle. He says there are three I's: the innovators, the imitators, and the idiots.
And the icing.
Ganache in this case, because fancy cupcakes. So the places like Magnolia Bakery in New York and later Georgetown Cupcakes here in D.C., those are the innovators.
They're the first ones to come in.
Right, the first ones. And they're doing really well right now. Here's Georgetown Cupcake owner Sophie LaMontagne.
We really didn't think that we were going to be this busy. Now, on Saturdays, we bake like 5,000 cupcakes a day, which is more than we ever thought in our wildest dreams.
They're baking 5,000 cupcakes a day?
5,000 a day. So obviously, this kind of success has inspired some attention, and imitators are starting to move in. And that's the stage we're in now. So what's next is the idiot stage, when companies try to expand way too much, way too quickly. And Dan Gross compared this to what happened with Starbucks.
It encouraged a lot of other coffee companies, the Peet's, the Caribou Coffees of the world, all these other chains and these homegrown ones. They built too many and they can't all make money, so they're shutting some of them down now.
All right, but there's no giant sort of Starbucks of cupcakes. There's no one single national brand.
No, there's not. But it's not the brand so much as it is the concept. You know, in this case, it was boutiques that make going out for a fancy cupcake an event.
And I mean, a cupcake costs about $4. I mean, it's not cheap.
No, but people can, you know, say it's an affordable luxury in a recession.
All right, so Selena, what happens now? Should I sell my stocks in cupcake companies?
Not quite yet. You might want to hold on to them a little bit longer. Here's what Dan Gross had to say.
There are many, many places in the U.S. that don't have standalone cupcake companies where people think they can make a go of it. So I don't think we're near the end yet.
So there are still cupcake opportunities, right?
Right. The glory days are not yet done.
Well, that's our producer, Selena Simmons-Duffin. Thanks for investigating and reporting back to us.
It was delicious. Thank you.